This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
The severe shortage of affordable housing in the Lower Mainland is leaving many people without suitable permanent accommodation. The increase in homelessness throughout the region has created a greater need for specific services: foods, beds, showers, clothes, and counseling. This need exists everywhere, not just in the inner core, the downtown east side, but in the suburbs, the residential areas, and places like Collingwood Renfrew. In response to the local need, Collingwood Neighborhood House has created a community shower and breakfast program in January of 2005. The program now provides services for up to 80 people in the neighborhood on any given day. Joanne Stevens is coordinator of the program, and she joins me now by phone. Good morning, Joanne.
It's a rainy morning out there for some people.
It certainly is, and I've seen a few people actually unsheltered in the rain this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the services that are provided by your program?
Well, on Saturday, we have a full service of breakfast and clothes, shower, support people here. Like this morning, we had a chiropractor here helping people with their backs and their aches and pains. And then they can get some support in terms of pastoral care, if you will, or some advice on how to access other services. And then on Wednesday morning, we don't have the showers, but we do have breakfast, and we have other kinds of care like medical care and help with finding housing and support to get the benefits that they might be entitled to get. And in both of those programs, the major focus is relationship building and trying to help people to find community and a different kind of community that they might already be connected up to that isn't really supporting them very well, and to get them ready to make the next step. Sometimes that takes people a year to do. Sometimes it takes them, you know, the first morning they come in. So everybody's different. Yeah.
So in a sense, providing...
That's kind of it in a nutshell. And then it gets more complex, of course, with everybody's different predicaments or circumstances that they find themselves in.
So in a sense, it's providing a kind of place, a safe place in the neighborhood where they become part of a greater extended community.
That's right. So they then get a kind of a community that they probably haven't been able to access, because if they've been in one particular area with all kinds of people that have similar problems that they have, here they're going to be connected with people who have more what we would call quote-unquote normal circumstances. It's a blended facility, so there are children here, grandma and grandpas, mums and dads, single people, young and old, and also great diversity in origins, ethnic origins. Yeah.
Who's taking part in the program?
Well, there are a lot of people taking part in the program. Are you thinking who organizes it?
No, who are the people who come to the program?
People who come to the program are regular folks in the neighborhood who are homed and homed well, and they're and working or retired. And we have a lot of seniors in our neighborhood and in the Renfrew Collingwood area at large, actually. And then also we have people who are poor and single family living in the neighborhood who come. And then we have people who are living in the neighborhood who would be homeless, but not absolutely homeless. So they might be couch surfing, that kind of thing. And then we do have people who are sleeping on the street. The other kind of people who come from their circumstances might be that they're living in the downtown area or in Burnaby. And so they make their way here. And the kind of overwhelming or the overarching purpose of them coming here is to get more of a normal experience. So there's this idea that it's not quite as ghettoized here, and it's not, it's different than what they're experiencing in other places. So it suits them better, I guess.
You started off with a very few people participating in the program, but have expanded significantly in less than a year. What are the challenges of coming to the neighborhood house for the first time for the people who want to use these services?
I can only tell you what people have told me, is that some felt nervous coming into a facility that they didn't know, and they may have even scoped us out from afar kind of thing, watching from the other side of the street for a while, and noticed that there are a wide variety of people who come here from different backgrounds and economic levels. And it does look a bit like an institution, although it doesn't function typically as an institution in the community. But so coming into some place that's strange and behaves differently than what they're normally coming to, their imagination works over time, so it takes them some time to come. The people who have been coming on a regular basis bring people, and what I hear is that the people that they're bringing need some encouragement to come. They can't believe that they would be welcome in a place that looks kind of like I say, a normal institution, like a school or a church or something. You know, they just don't want to be that visible. But when they come, they see that isn't the case here, that they are very welcome. We want them to come. We want them to be here. And so we function differently here. So when they come through the door, we greet them and help them to find out where they can go to get their showers and get the equipment they need, or their hygiene equipment to shower, and to let them know that that they can have pretty much whatever we have, that we can meet their needs, they can ask for. And then they can have breakfast and have what they need there as well.
Okay. You've described quite well how word of mouth has kind of worked to kind of extend the trust that people who are already attending were feeling, and brought in other people sort of as a result of that. But how did you, when you first threw your doors open, how did you first begin to attract the people that you wanted to come to the neighborhood house?
Well, we were so excited about being able to do this, and to some degree, with this particular kind of population, we didn't have experience about offering this kind of service. A lot of people had connected with people who were homeless or living in abject poverty before, and weren't concerned about connecting with people in these kinds of circumstances. But in terms of the actual operation, we were quite organized. We discovered, although we didn't know that we were as organized as we needed to be, but we discovered that we were. And so that freed us up. A lot of the volunteers were quite excited to be able to support people in our neighborhood in these circumstances. So they would come in the morning with their cars, and if nobody was here, and nobody came for the first 4 weeks, we made lunches, many bags of lunches, and they got in the cars and they went and looked for people who were homeless or looking in need of community, and took the lunches to them or left lunches at sites where people were obviously sleeping if they weren't there, and left notices about where we could be found, and encouraged people to come and brought them.
Within the neighborhood house itself, did you encounter any stereotypes or fears that people within the neighborhood house had about the homeless when you started up the program?
Oh, yes, we did. In some cases, there were absolutely no fears, but in other cases, there were. And largely, that had to do with people's comfortability about knowing what to do, feeling confident and assured that we knew, or some of us knew, what we were doing, and that we knew the people who were coming. That was large. That took away a lot of fear when people knew that we knew the people who were coming, that we knew them on first name basis. And so we did a lot of training, and we received a lot of feedback from people in the community, in community organizations, in business, within our own staff, and other participants of other programs. And we took that very seriously, and we used that material to help answer the questions that they had and to support them to be able to be welcoming to people who they wouldn't normally encounter on a day-to-day basis in an institution.
Did you encounter fears that would be fears around, for instance, children or safety, that sort of thing?
We had fears certainly around children. Should my child see people who look like this? Would our children be safe, or would they, you know, be? I'm only imagining in myself, but from, you know, you can get a sense of what people are fearing about. Will my children be, is it okay, is it hygienic enough where these people sit and so on? Can my children crawl in the same space? Will they hurt my children? Will they speak in a way that is respectful around children? And then we had some parents who were concerned about what they imagined to be drug use, and then we had fears from seniors about being safe because they're so vulnerable. We had concerns around theft. We had the major concern, though, that stands out for me. Others may have different experiences, but it stands out for me is how to talk to people. How can we get connected with them? And we don't have any. I get feedback, I don't have any experience with people, I have nothing in common to share. And just a comment like that helps to tell people the kinds of things, in fact, that they really do share.
And were you able to work with people in your community to ameliorate some of these fears or to respond to some of them?
Well, sure. And we did have, we did have people coming in who needed to learn how to be here in a way that was respectful, and that provided opportunity to connect people up in more helpful ways with one another, and then we had meetings. With all the various departments in our organization, and we had meetings with some of the participant groups. And the other thing is, it's very important in this program, and it's sort of the foundation of the program, is that there are a number of organizations in the community that sit on the committee. So we have that reach of other organizations also helping people to understand and become more integrated here. So it's, you know, the health center, for instance, up the street, the church across the street, the Renfrew Community Center. So there was these tentacles out in the community also receiving and talking to people.
Joanne, do you think that we see the full extent of homelessness in our neighborhoods?
I don't. But because we don't see it, I can't be absolutely certain. But what I hear often is that, you know, there are people who come here who are absolutely homeless, and that's a term that's often used for people who are living in tents or on benches and so on. For me, I wouldn't say absolutely homeless that way, because I value wherever they're living as their home and their way of making that home possible for themselves. But that would be a term that you would often hear. There are the hidden homeless in the sense that people are living on couches or going from relative to relative or friend to friend. And then there are people also who can be understood as homeless if they're paying more than 30% of their income. Some people would call that at risk of homelessness, but if they don't have that security of a home, it's hard to call it home. You know, if it's not really there for you in a very sure way where you can live freely and flourish, and begin to flourish, yeah.
Can I ask you, just in a nutshell, to say if you were the government, what measures you think need to happen to solve homelessness?
Mm-hmm. Well, people in our committee and in this organization speak to government agencies and other support agencies all the time. And one of the things that we advocate is certainly that there be more affordable housing, that there be different kinds of housing to help people in stages to move from the street through until they can make steps where they're quite independent and can live independently. So there are many stages of housing that could be developed. We are interested in intensive support so that the curve of healing and being on their feet can be much stronger and have much greater effect and be much shorter. We also advocate increased income in terms of social assistance that various people get, and that is, I think, probably one of the major steps to getting housed and having some security to be able to think about, you know, getting housing or think about having regular food coming in. And then the other thing that we advocate too is healthcare and other organizations getting involved in similar ways as ourselves to help people to get to those places where they can make those next steps.
How can people get information on Collingwood Neighbor Houses program and get involved in that?
They'd be able to do that by calling here. The telephone number is 604-435-0323. And so they can learn, come and have breakfast. You know, we can't take the whole city at once, but if you have a chance over the winter time and spring, come and have breakfast with us. It's open to everyone. Those who can afford can to give a donation. We'd gladly receive that so that we can continue our work. And then also, if they want more detail or if they would like to volunteer or donate to the program, then they can call me and ask for me.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, good luck with the program.
Okay. Have a good day now.
Bye now.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Joanne Stevens. She's the program coordinator of the Community Shower and Breakfast Program at the Collingwood Neighborhood House. And the phone number that she gave, if you want to get in contact with them, is 604-435-0323. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Single-room occupancy, or SRO, residential hotels provide housing for many of Vancouver's low-income residents, especially in the downtown east side. SRO units provide one of the few options for the working poor and for people whose welfare payments provide only $325 a month for rent. Despite the existence of tenants' rights protections, residents of SROs often find themselves powerless to address abuse. But now a group of SRO residents are fighting back. On September 15th, 2005, last year, Vancouver police and fire officials conducted a raid on the Pender Hotel. Residents say that during this raid, their property was destroyed, personal injury was inflicted, and they were wrongfully detained. Seven Pender Hotel residents have filed a lawsuit against the city, and David Eby is a lawyer with the Pivot Legal Society and is representing the Pender Hotel residents. And he's joined me this morning in the studio. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. We're eager to hear your ideas on this. So what happened first, a little bit more detail, on September 15th at the Pender Hotel?
Well, what happened at the Pender Hotel that day was there's a group called the Neighborhood Integrated Services Team, which is police, fire, city officials, that does inspections at these residential hotels throughout Vancouver, especially when there are problems. So they were at the Pender Hotel that day, and they were doing an inspection. And during the inspection, the firefighter said that he felt ill and went out and received medical attention. So shortly after that, someone, either the fire department or the police department or both, decided to bring in the hazardous, the hazmat team, the hazardous materials inspection team. So they come in their spacesuits. And the fear was that there was a meth lab in the building. That's what they said was the reason why this firefighter had become or at least felt ill. And in response to that, what they did was quite shocking. They took the people who were still in the building and took them out of the building and held them at the side, directly beside the building, which was supposed to be this incredible chemical and fire hazard, surrounded them with police. There was a group of about 15 people out there. And then the hazardous materials team, despite being offered keys by both the manager and by a police officer who had collected keys from some of the tenants along the side of the building, they went in and kicked in every door in the hotel room that was locked, so causing incredible damage inside the hotel. And then when they didn't find a meth lab, they said, sorry about the problem, folks. Sorry about detaining you outside for 7 hours while we did this. You're free to go back in your building, which is in the middle of the downtown east side, which now unfortunately has no front door, and your room you can't lock anymore because we've kicked it in or we kicked it off the hinges. But you know, have a great day. And needless to say, my clients were less than impressed with that, and so we've they've instructed me to go to court.
Is this this treatment similar to how people are treated at other SROs in the city?
Well, one of the major this is a huge example. This is like a macro example. This is the most extreme that I've heard of, but I've only been doing this kind of work in the downtown east side for 6 months, so maybe it happens more regularly, but Every day there are lower level incidents between police and residents. For example, I have a couple clients right now with complaints going regarding police just coming into hotel rooms and pushing open doors, doors that aren't locked, while the residents are in the room and saying, oh, we're just doing a room check. Who's in this room? What's your name? Things that would never happen in other apartment buildings and in the downtown or in any part of Vancouver or even in most of Canada. So it's a special kind of treatment that people get down here. And my clients often think that it's the reason why they receive this treatment is because they're poor. And I'm inclined to agree with them.
Special as in I can do without the special treatment.
Yeah, as in please, no special treatment.
Is this the first time SRO residents have filed a lawsuit against the city for this?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, I've looked at the case law, and I can't find another example of something on a huge scale like this. I found a couple of cases where people were concerned about how police responded to 911 calls that kind of thing, sort of a lower level thing. But as far as evacuating a building and kicking in every door and then leaving the building in the condition it was, despite being asked to repair it, I can't find anything like that. The reason, I think, is because it hasn't happened before. So it'll be a very interesting case, and it'll be interesting to see what the court has to say about the kind of treatment that the residents of the Pender received at the hands of the City of Vancouver.
So what should a City of Vancouver be doing to improve the quality of life in SROs? I mean, that's another real... Yeah. Existing situation regardless of these interventions.
Sure, there's something called the Standards of Maintenance Bylaw, and that allows the City Council to pass an order or a motion that says that a hotel has to correct a certain maintenance issue. So there's a whole series of standards, as the name of the bylaw implies, that rooming houses need to abide by, or residential hotels need to abide by. And if they don't, Council can pass this motion, and if they don't correct the situation, Council can have city staff go in and actually do the repairs themselves and then bill the owner out of the property taxes. And this is something the city hasn't done for a long time. The last time they did it was at the Columbia Hotel, and the Columbia Hotel sued them, saying that the repairs they did were too extensive and not necessary. And since then, the city has been pretty gun-shy and has refused to do these repairs.
And what about social housing, providing that?
Well, I'll tell you, I was at a city council meeting yesterday and the day before about Southeast False Creek, and it was really frustrating to see the discussion about reducing the required social housing in that area from 30% to 20%, which I just read in the Sun this morning is what council decided to do. And the reason why it's so frustrating is because housing for low-income singles is disappearing. These hotel rooms are disappearing from the downtown east side, and they're disappearing for a number of reasons. They're still there, but some buildings are being used exclusively by students. We've lost over 200 rooms to that. Some hotels are in the process of converting to exclusively student use, and rents are going crazy. In the last 2 years, rents have gone up $10. The average rent is now $361 a month in these affordable, quote-unquote, houses, while people are receiving $325 a month from their welfare rent supplement. And so the number of rooms that rent for less than $380 a month decreased by 11% in the last 2 years. So we've lost almost over 400 rooms in the last 2 years. These are City of Vancouver numbers. And interestingly, in the same time, we've seen homelessness double, more than 600 more people on the street counted by the Greater Vancouver Regional District in the City of Vancouver in the same period of time. Now, it's not a one-to-one relationship, but certainly we can look at these numbers and say there are fewer hotel rooms available to people, there are more homeless people, maybe there's something that we can correlate here.
This is a very different picture than I understand the City of Vancouver report, which they released last summer, which said that low-income housing is actually increasing in the downtown core.
Yeah, was that ever frustrating? They released this low-income housing survey that suggested for low-income singles there was actually a gain of 99 hotel rooms over the two-year period. Unfortunately, in that survey, they counted this student housing as being available to low-income singles. And when I corresponded with them, they said, well, technically students are low-income singles. And, you know, point taken. But we're talking about people who are on welfare, who are receiving $325 a month to live on. And also saying that they need to track hotel rooms, even when the rent goes above $380 a month, which is an arbitrary number that Pivot chose to examine as a threshold where people can no longer afford these rooms. And saying that they can still count these rooms as low-income housing is totally ridiculous to me. And in fact, it was the Downtown Eastside Housing Plan was passed based on the presumption that housing levels have been stable in the Downtown Eastside and in the downtown core based on this survey. And yesterday, city staff acknowledged during this False Creek debate that in fact the city has not been replacing housing on a one-to-one basis in the downtown core. And that's contrary to this survey and to what the Downtown Eastside Housing Plan was based on. So it's very frustrating to us, but we're glad now that at least they're recognizing that they're not replacing the housing on a one-to-one basis.
So that city council that passed that Downtown East housing plan in fall of last year, you feel were misled by staff or didn't really look hard enough at the submissions of groups like Pivot Society and other community groups to critically assess the information they were being given by the staff?
That's right. Misled is a strong word. I think that there's a certain inertia that was taking place with this survey. No one had looked at it carefully in a while. No one had taken a critical look at how the numbers were added up and that kind of thing. And as a result, they passed this in the mistaken belief that housing was being replaced and being sustained, and that the Downtown East Side somehow could continue on the track that it's on. But unfortunately, if it continues on the track that it's on, we're going to be looking at thousands of people in the streets in the City of Vancouver. And we've already had one death for sure directly from homelessness. That was Francis McAllister. And I just read in today's paper that the body of the man that they found out at UBC was he was a homeless man, and that he died of exposure in damp weather conditions that neared zero. So that will be our second death of the year. So I just wonder how many people have to die on the street before we before we start building some social housing in this city.
And I want to go back to that point of students and working poor and people on welfare. It seems that the welfare people then are really the most vulnerable of those three still discriminated categories of people.
Yeah, the people we're focusing on are the people most at risk of homelessness. Pivot's interest is homelessness prevention, as is DIRA's and a number of other groups in the Downtown East Side. And so we're looking at people who are getting this $325 a month shelter allowance. And if they can't afford to rent a place, then they're going to be on the street. Whereas people like students will just live somewhere else or stay with their parents or with friends. These are people without family, without other connections that you rely on to be your safety net. They're at the very end of their rope. And if it's not a Downtown East Side residential hotel, which quite frankly, some of them you wouldn't want your worst enemy to live in, then there's nowhere else to go. I mean, It's a very difficult situation for them and very frustrating for us to see.
What would you like to have people do in support of the lawsuit?
Well, in support of the lawsuit, I mean, one of the challenges that we faced was that the chief of the fire department was not interested in doing an investigation or discussing the Pender Hotel matter with us at all, which was why we had to go to the lawsuit. So certainly people could talk to their city councilors about having folks in the downtown east side treated with respect during these fire inspections and urge their councilors to deal with this situation appropriately. The other thing would be great is we have a federal election coming up, and if people would ask candidates, what are they going to do about housing down here? Because we have not had any federal housing money before this $1.6 billion that the NDP sort of tacked on to the last budget for a long time. Be sure to check with your candidates about that.
Well, thanks a lot for coming in, David, and explaining this so clearly.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. I've been speaking with David Eby. He is a lawyer with the Pivot Legal Society, and you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.